This morning's sports headlines are the kind Tiger Woods has been craving for months. Nothing about scandal, everything about golf. The headlines are blaring, Tiger is back after he played his best ever opening round of the Masters golf tournament yesterday. It was his first competitive golf since last November when news broke, linking Woods to numerous extramarital affairs. From Augusta, Georgia, NPR's Tom Goldman reports.
Try as it might to make Tiger Woods' re-entry as smooth as possible, the Augusta National Golf Club apparently can't control the skies. That's where a little prop plane circled yesterday, minutes before Woods' first tee shot, dragging a sign jabbing at Woods' claim that his post-scandal self-exploration has led him back to Buddhism. The sign read, "Tiger, did you mean Buddhism?" Wood said later he didn't see the sign, probably because he was too busy acknowledging the crowd that greeted him on the first tee like an old friend. After powering his opening drive into the fairway, Woods got into his rhythm quickly, hitting the ball and placing his shots really well. If only he'd putted better, he said afterwards, it would have been a pretty special round. His 4-under par 68 was special enough. It was his best opening round score at Augusta ever. And this was a guy who was supposed to be rusty after a nearly 5-month layoff. But Woods said everyone made the mistake of thinking the layoff from competition also was a layoff from practice. It wasn't.
My practice sessions had to be more intense than usual. And you don't have to play a lot of events, but if you take your practice seriously, and then go out there and play like you did, like you practiced, and then everything will be all right.
As pleased as he was with his game, Woods called it incredible, the reception he got from the Augusta patrons lining the course. And he reciprocated a lot. At times, walking down the fairway, he looked like someone on a float in a parade, waving, smiling, making eye contact.
I was saying thank you all day.
It's part of the Tiger Reclamation Project. More accessible, better golf manners, too. At times yesterday, a lot of heads didn't turn to watch the ball flight after he hit. People were watching Tiger to see whether the man who now speaks of spiritual centering could keep his infamous potty mouth in check. One major test on a bungled fairway shot on 14, Augusta resident Dennis O'Connor was a witness.
He had a bad shot, and he said, "Oh, God." Somebody walking the other way turned around and says, "You hear that curse word?" He said, "He didn't curse." He said, "Oh, God." I mean, we heard him clearly. Yeah.
Such is life for Tiger Woods under the new super-duper high-resolution microscope, as opposed to the plain old microscope he was under before. If it's having an effect on his psyche, it's not showing on the golf course, nor in the interview room, the same interview room where Monday Woods was his ingratiating best as he fended off questions about the scandal in his first press conference since it broke. Yesterday, after his first round, Woods was back in golfer mode, regardless of the questions.
Tiger, what did today mean? What did it mean to you?
It meant I'm 2 shots off the lead. That's what it means.
That lead is held by veteran Fred Couples, age 50. Tom Watson, age 60, the oldest guy in the field, is in a tie for second. Watson and Couples at the top of the Masters leaderboard? Now that's a headline, but one that'll have to wait until we figure out what Tiger's going to do over the next 3 days. Tom Goldman, NPR News, Augusta.
An update now on real estate. The housing bust has made it possible for many who want to own homes to jump into the market, at least in theory. But these entry-level buyers are facing stiff competition from professional house flippers and other investors. From member station KQED, Stephanie Martin reports.
California resident Andrew Cummings says he didn't understand why his wife, Akemi, was so set on owning a home until she took him to Japan and showed him the tiny shack where she grew up.
By American standards, it wasn't up to snuff. And basically, from then on, she's always had a dream of buying a house.
But when the couple married 10 years ago, that dream remained a distant one. They were living in San Francisco, one of the priciest real estate markets in the country. All they could afford was a studio apartment, and even that was $1,200 a month.
And this is while I was driving taxi cab, working in a plant nursery, doing landscape maintenance while I was in school for landscape architecture.
Cummings says after he graduated, they considered buying a small condo in Contra Costa County, a less expensive area about 45 minutes east of San Francisco. But the price tag was still too high at $325,000. Then late last year, as foreclosures in the county hit record levels and home prices plummeted, they resumed the search for a dream home. The problem this time, though, wasn't the price. It was the competition.
A lot of the places I looked at, I would always see like a Mercedes and a Lexus parked out front. And there's no way that somebody's driving a Mercedes was going to be buying the house that we were looking at.
Cummings repeatedly ran into and was beaten to the punch by what's known as vulture investors because of their appetite for foreclosures. Their goal? Refurbish the homes quickly and sell them for a profit.
1720, unit B.
Twice a day, each weekday, about two dozen or so gather on the steps of the Contra Costa County Courthouse to bid on local homes. They carry stacks of cashier's checks.
Yeah, we're all friends, sort of like attorneys, you know. They all smile and say hello to each other, but they cut each other's throat every chance they get. Same thing.
Scott Jones says he's been investing in homes for years, but right now he and his competitors are especially hungry to make the most of the depressed market. They enter fierce bidding wars, driving up prices.
People are paying a lot of money for houses, making it very difficult to make money.
But making money is not what it's about for regular buyers like Andrew and Akemi Cummings. They just want a home. But they're at a disadvantage. Unlike professional investors, they'll have to live with any problems the house might have. All cash was never an option. Andrew Cummings says they found the perfect four-bedroom in Contra Costa for $200,000, made an offer, and watched with anguish as they lost it to an investor.
We're playing with our heartstrings here. This buying a home is our dream. And to get beat out, you know, for somebody just looking to make a quick buck, it's not a very good feeling.
This is my dream room.
Still, the house hunt had a happy ending, and the Cummings' daughter, Kaide, even got the pink bedroom she was hoping for.
And I have two kitchens. One...
Plenty of room for her toy kitchens with plastic pots and pans.
Big, big, big.
That's how Akemi Cummings describes the three-bedroom home they moved into last month. It's larger than anything she ever imagined living in. They found the home on an internet site, listed under the wrong county. They pounced, moving so quickly, vulture investors had no time to find out about it. The cost? $195,000. Now the Cummings hope they'll be on the right side of the home buying curve. At the peak of the housing boom, this house sold for over $500,000. For NPR News, I'm Stephanie Martin.
And you can follow the foreclosure crisis by subscribing to our Planet Money podcast at npr.org.
Sitcom fans will be excited to see that two TV superstars, Steve Carell and Tina Fey, are on the big screen in a new romantic action comedy called Date Night. Film critic David Edelstein says they haven't brought their sophisticated brand of comedy along with them.
One of the funniest things in Date Night isn't actually in Date Night, but on one of the movie's several posters. Tina Fey is in her gauzy, purplish party dress, spattered with mud, her hair all splayed out. But with her right hand, she's smoothing the ends in a cool, sexy way. That pose gives a hint of Fey's brilliance. It's the teensy neurotic, or maybe obsessive-compulsive, gesture that's totally at odds with what's happening in the moment. She's not just a gifted mimic. As she proved in her Sarah Palin impersonations, Fey grasps the continuum between her character's vanity and insanity. The movies haven't done her justice. But then, movies are increasingly the lesser medium for comic actors like Fey and her Date Night co-star Steve Carell. They're the stars of two network sitcoms that have moved the boundary posts. Yet their comedies on the big screen are bloated and generic. You see them working too hard to be funny, doing broad shtick that's only tangentially related to the characters they're playing. The premise of Date Night is perfectly serviceable, classic even. It's the old North by Northwest mistaken identity nightmare. A New Jersey couple named Phil and Claire Foster fear their domestic life has become stale and wearying and decide to hit the town and rekindle their youthful passion. But they overreach. They get in way over their heads. At a super trendy Manhattan restaurant where they don't have a prayer of getting a table, Phil takes another couple's reservation when that couple doesn't answer the hostess's page. They have such a great meal and so much good wine that they almost don't mind when two men they think work for the restaurant order them to leave the table and bring them out to the alley.
I want to talk to your boss right now.
think we both know that's not gonna happen, Mr. Triplehorn. Or should I say, Phil Foster.
Next time you make a dinner reservation, don't use the same alias as your ransom notes, genius.
Let me explain. My husband, very sweetly but delusionally, thought that we could make it here early enough to get a table. And right. We didn't. We were late.
They
and
were
when
so
we
rude, that
heard
one guy.
Them calling the reservation for Triplehorns, he was like, us. And that's... so we took it.
So you just took somebody else's reservation?
For the record, I was against it. But my husband gets these plans in his head, and it becomes like a thing.
I'm an idiot.
Even with material this uninspired, Faye and Carell have style and aplomb. Carell has a good frozen deadpan. He's often funnier when he's just about to speak than when he finally gets the words out. When the camera sits back and just watches them, their rhythms are rather exquisite. So are their scenes with Mark Wahlberg as an old real estate client of Claire's who helps them figure out who's hunting them. Wahlberg is shirtless and so pumped up that his trapezoid muscles have their own trapezoid muscles, and Faye stares at him and babbles away, glassy-eyed, while Carell stares at him with so much shame at his own puny status he can barely speak. But Date Night is not a movie that honors exquisite rhythms. It's a movie that calls for big, whacking hysteria and dumb slapstick and car chases. The director, Sean Levy, made Night at the Museum and its sequel and the Steve Martin remakes of The Pink Panther and Cheaper by the Dozen. He's considered one of Hollywood's top comedy directors, probably because he bashes things along so that kids have a good time and parents don't get bored. But he's a comedy killer. Even potentially great bits, when Carell and Faye pretend to be a pimp and a prostitute and perform the nerdiest pole dance in film history, don't build and pay off. The supporting actors who have to carry the plot, something to do with a corrupt DA and a blackmailing gangster, which is lazy and slapdash even by dumb comedy standards, look marooned. There are great TV comedians who push the envelope on screen. Ricky Gervais, who created the role on The Office that Steve Carell Americanized, made the daringly irreverent The Invention of Lying. Will Ferrell hit dizzying slapstick heights in Step Brothers. I'm not sure Carell and Faye are in their league, but if they keep working in vehicles like this, how will we ever know?
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine.
And today's last word in business is caller beware. We all know about the hazards of using cell phones while driving, but it turns out that talking or texting can be perilous even when you are not behind the wheel. The Consumer Product Safety Commission reports that cell phones are involved in mishaps that lead to emergency room visits, including the following actual accidents. A teen was on the phone while lifting weights and dropped a barbell on himself. A 21-year-old was texting while riding his bike and crashed, scraping his face. Apparently the phone wasn't large enough to provide some protection. And there was a man who sliced his hand cutting chicken while talking on the phone. Cell phones are sometimes used as weapons, too, missiles or bludgeons, leading to hundreds of emergency room visits over the past 4 years. Renee, I have a cell phone in hand. Be nice to me.
Okay, I'll be very careful around you,
Thank
Steve.
You.
And that is the business news from NPR News this morning. Our show is edited by Martha Wexler and Didi Skanky. The editorial staff includes Rina Advani, Theo Balcom, Ann Hawk, Kitty Isley, Jordana Hochman, Maeve McGoran, Courtney Dorning, and Laura Krantz, with Shannon Rhodes and Sasha Woodruff here at NPR West.
Our executive producer is Madalika Sicca. Morning Edition's theme music was written by BJ Lederman and arranged by Jim Pugh. You can follow the show on Twitter at Morning Edition. You can also follow me at NPR Inskeep. And you can find me on Facebook as well. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montagne.